طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, where we present the Palestinian voice speaking in resistance to Israel's military occupation and colonization of their homeland. We have a very full program today, so we need to get right to it. South Africa has begun its prosecution of Israel for genocide in the International Court of Justice in The Hague, Netherlands. Today we focus on the opening arguments outlining their case, beginning with Blinny Grayley, an Irish lawyer who is advising South Africa's legal team in the ICJ. Here she is speaking to the court, presenting the case for why Israel's actions in Gaza meet the standards for genocide.
Madam President, members of the court, there is an urgent need for provisional measures to protect Palestinians in Gaza from the irreparable prejudice caused by Israel's violations of the Genocide Convention. The United Nations Secretary General and its chiefs describe the situation in Gaza variously as a crisis of humanity, a living hell, a bloodbath, a situation of utter deepening and unmatched horror, where an entire population is besieged and under attack, denied access to the essentials for survival on a massive scale. As the United Nations Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs stated last Friday, and I quote, "Gaza has become a place of death and despair. Families are sleeping in the open as temperatures plummet. Areas where civilians were told to relocate for their safety have come under relentless attack, bombardment. Medical facilities are under relentless attack. The few hospitals that are partially functional are overwhelmed with trauma cases, critically short of all supplies, and inundated by desperate people seeking safety. A public health disaster is unfolding. Infectious diseases are spreading in overcrowded shelters as sewers spill over. Some 180 women are giving birth daily amidst this chaos. People are facing the highest levels of food insecurity ever recorded. Famine is around the corner. For children in particular, the last 12 weeks have been traumatic. No food, no water, no school, nothing but the terrifying sounds of war, day in and day out. Gaza has simply become uninhabitable. Its people are witnessing daily threats to their very existence, while the world watches on." End quote. The court has heard of the horrific death toll and of the more than 7,000 Palestinian men, women and children reported missing, presumed dead or dying slow, excruciating deaths trapped under the rubble. Reports of field executions and torture and ill-treatment are mounting, as are images of decomposing bodies of Palestinian men, women and children left unburied where they were killed, some being picked upon by animals. It is becoming ever clearer that huge swathes of Gaza, entire towns, villages, refugee camps, are being wiped from the map. As you have heard, but it bears repeating, according to the World Food Programme, 4 out of 5 people in the world in famine or a catastrophic type of hunger are in Gaza right now. Indeed, experts warn that deaths from starvation and disease risk significantly outstripping deaths from bombings. The daily statistics stand as clear evidence of the urgency and of the irreparable prejudice. On the basis of the current figures, on average, 247 Palestinians are being killed and are at risk of being killed each day, many of them literally blown to pieces. They include 48 mothers each day, two every hour, and over 117 children each day, leading UNICEF to call Israel's actions a war on children. On current rates, which show no sign of abating, each day, over three medics, two teachers, more than one United Nations employee, and more than one journalist will be killed, many while at work or in what appear to be targeted attacks on their family homes or where they are sheltering. The risk of famine will increase each day. Each day, an average of 629 people will be wounded, some multiple times over, as they move from place to place, desperately seeking sanctuary. Each day, over 10 Palestinian children will have one or both legs amputated, many without anaesthetic. Each day, on current rates, an average of 3,900 Palestinian homes will be damaged or destroyed. More mass graves will be dug. More cemeteries will be bulldozed and bombed, and corpses violently exhumed, denying even the dead any dignity or peace. Each day, ambulances, hospitals, and medics will continue to be attacked and killed. The first responders who have spent 3 months without international assistance, trying to dig families out of the rubble with their bare hands, will continue to be targeted. On current figures, one will be killed almost every second day, sometimes in attacks launched against those attending the scene to rescue the wounded. Each day, yet more desperate people will be forced to relocate from where they are sheltering or will be bombed in places where they have been told to evacuate to. Entire multi-generational families will be obliterated. And yet more Palestinian children will become WCNSF, Wounded Child, No Surviving Family, the terrible new acronym born out of Israel's genocidal assault on the Palestinian population in Gaza. There is an urgent need for provisional measures to prevent imminent, irreparable prejudice to the rights in issue in this case. There could not be a clearer or more compelling case. In the words of the Commissioner General of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, there must be an end to the decimation of Gaza and of its people. Turning to the court's case law, as the court has recently reaffirmed, and I quote, the condition of urgency is met when acts susceptible of causing irreparable prejudice can occur at any moment before the court makes a final decision on the case, end quote. That is precisely the situation here. Any of those matters to which I have referred can and are occurring at any moment. United Nations Security Council resolutions demanding, quote, the immediate, safe, unhindered delivery of humanitarian assistance at scale throughout Gaza and full, rapid, safe and unhindered humanitarian access, end quote, remain unimplemented. United Nations General Assembly resolutions calling for a humanitarian ceasefire have been ignored. The situation could not be more urgent. Since these proceedings were initiated on the 29th of December 2023 alone, an estimated over 1,703 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza and over 3,252 injured. As to the criterion of irreparable prejudice, for decades now, the court has repeatedly found it to be satisfied in situations where serious risks arise to human life or to other fundamental rights. In the cases of Georgia, Russia, and Armenia, Azerbaijan, the court ordered provisional measures, having found a serious risk of irreparable prejudice where hundreds of thousands of people had been forced from their homes. In ordering provisional measures in the latter case, the court noted the context of, I quote, the long-standing exposure of the population to a situation of vulnerability, including hindrances to the importation of essential goods, causing shortages of food, medicine, and other life-saving medical supplies, end quote. In Gaza, as you have heard, nearly 2 million people, over 85% of the population, have been repeatedly forced to flee their homes and shelters, not just once or twice, but some three, four, or more times over, into shrinking slivers of land where they continue to be bombed and killed. This is a population that Israel had already made vulnerable through 16 years of military blockade and crippling de-development. Today, Israel's hindrances to the import of food and essential items have brought Gaza to the brink of famine, with adults, mothers, fathers, grandparents regularly foregoing food for the day so that children can eat at least something. Medicine shortages and the lack of medical treatment, clean water and electricity are so great that large numbers of Palestinians are dying or are at imminent risk of dying preventable deaths. Cancer and other services have long shut down. Women are undergoing cesarean sections without anaesthetic in barely functioning hospitals, described as scenes from a horror movie, with many undergoing otherwise unnecessary hysterectomies in an attempt to save their lives. In the Canada-Syria torture case, the court made clear that, I quote, individuals subject to torture and other acts of cruel, inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment are at serious risk of irreparable prejudice. Well, Palestinians in Gaza are also at risk of such irreparable prejudice, with videos of Palestinian boys and men rounded up and stripped and degraded broadcast to the world, alongside footage of serious bodily harm and accounts of serious mental harm and humiliation. In Qatar, United Arab Emirates, the court considered provisional measures to be justified, having regard to the risk of irreparable prejudice deriving from factors such as people being forced to leave their places of residence without the possibility of return, the psychological distress of temporary or potentially ongoing separation from their families, and the harm associated with students being prevented from taking their exams. If provisional measures were justified there, how could they not be in Gaza, where countless families have been separated, with some family members evacuating under Israeli military orders and others staying behind at extreme risk to care for the wounded, infirm and the elderly, where husbands, fathers and sons are being rounded up and separated from their families, taken to unknown locations for indeterminate periods of time. In the Qatar case, the court issued a provisional order where harm to approximately 150 students was an issue. In Gaza, 625,000 schoolchildren have not attended school for 3 months, with the United Nations Security Council expressing deep concern, I quote, that the disruption of access to education has a dramatic impact on children and that conflict has lifelong effects on their physical and mental health. Almost 90,000 Palestinian university students cannot attend at university in Gaza. Over 60% of schools, almost all universities, and countless bookshops and libraries have been damaged or destroyed, and hundreds of teachers and academics have been killed, including deans of universities and leading Palestinian scholars, obliterating the very prospects for the future education of Gaza's children and young people. Notably, the court has found provisional measures to be justified in all three cases where they were previously sought in relation to violations of the Genocide Convention. It did so in Bosnia and Serbia in 1993 finding on the basis of evidence that was certainly no more compelling than that presently before the court, that it was sufficient to determine that there was, and I quote, a grave risk of acts of genocide being committed. The court found provisional measures to be justified in the Gambia-Myanmar case on the basis of a risk of irreparable prejudice to the Rohingya, subject to, quote, mass killings as well as beatings, the destruction of villages and homes, denial of access to food, shelter, and other essentials of life. More recently, in indicating provisional measures in Ukraine-Russia, the court considered that Russia's military activities had, quote, resulted in numerous civilian deaths and injuries and caused significant material damage, including the destruction of buildings and infrastructure, end quote, giving rise to a risk of irreparable prejudice. The court had regard to the fact that, quote, attacks are ongoing and are creating increasingly difficult living conditions for the civilian population, end quote, which it considered to be extremely vulnerable. The court also considered the fact that, I quote again, many persons have no access to the most basic foodstuffs, potable water, electricity, essential medicines or heating, and that many were attempting to flee under extremely insecure conditions. This is occurring in Gaza on a much more intensive scale to a besieged, trapped, terrified population that has nowhere safe to go. Lest the contrary be suggested, it is clear from Ukraine-Russia that the fact that the urgent risk of irreparable harm arises in a situation of armed conflict does not undermine, much less preclude, a request for provisional measures. That's also clear from the court's other judgments. So in the case of armed activities on the territory of the Congo, for example, the court ordered provisional measures based on its finding that, quote, persons, assets, and resources present on the territory of the Congo, particularly in the area of conflict, remain extremely vulnerable, and that there was a serious risk that rights at issue in the case may suffer irreparable prejudice, end quote. Similarly, in Costa Rica, Nicaragua, the court indicated provisional measures in part on the basis that the presence of troops in the disputed territory gave rise, I quote, to a real and present risk of incidents liable to cause irremediable harm in the form of bodily injury or death, end quote. In relation to the Genocide Convention in particular, the court recalled in Gambia-Myanmar that, quote, states parties expressly confirmed their willingness to consider genocide as a crime under international law, which they must prevent and punish independently of the context of peace or of war in which it takes place. End quote. More recently, in the case of Guyana-Venezuela, the court considered that the serious risk of Venezuela, quote, acquiring and exercising control and administration of the territory in dispute, end quote, gave rise to a risk of irreparable prejudice to the rights asserted in the case. Similar factors are in issue here, having regard to the territorial ambitions and settlement plans for Gaza being raised by members of the Israeli government and the relationship of those factors to the very survival of Palestinians in Gaza as such. Similarly, any scaling up by Israel of access of humanitarian relief to Gaza in response to these proceedings or otherwise would be no answer to South Africa's request for provisional measures. In the case of Iran-United States, the court found a risk of irreparable harm from the exposure of individuals to danger to health and life caused by restrictions placed on medicines and medical devices, foodstuffs, and other goods required for humanitarian needs. That was notwithstanding the assurances offered by the United States for it to expedite the consideration of humanitarian issues, and notwithstanding the fact that essentials were in any event exempt from the United States sanctions. The court considered that the assurances were, I quote, not adequate to address fully the humanitarian and safety concerns raised, and that there remained a risk that measures adopted by the United States may entail irreparable consequences. In Armenia, Azerbaijan, unilateral undertakings to alleviate restrictions alongside the full resumption of humanitarian and commercial deliveries did not defeat a request for the indication of provisional measures. The court was clear that while contributing, quote, towards mitigating the imminent risk of irreparable prejudice resulting from the military operation, those developments did not remove the risk entirely. Indeed, in Georgia, Russia, the court made clear that it considers a serious risk to subsist where, quote, the situation is unstable and could rapidly change. The court considered, quote, given the ongoing tension and the absence of an overall settlement to the conflict in this region, populations also remain vulnerable, end quote. Israel continues to deny that it is responsible for the humanitarian crisis it has created, even as Gaza starves. The aid it has belatedly begun to allow in is wholly inadequate and does not come anywhere close to the average 500 trucks being permitted daily before October 2023, even under the blockade. Any unilateral undertakings Israel might seek to give about future aid would not remove the risk of irreparable prejudice, not least considering Israel's past and current conduct towards the Palestinian people, including the 16 years of brutal siege on Gaza. In any event, as the United Nations Secretary General has made absolutely clear, it is a mistake to measure, a quote, the effectiveness of the humanitarian operation in Gaza based on the number of trucks allowed in. As he stressed, I quote, the real problem is that the way Israel is conducting this offensive means that the conditions for the effective delivery of humanitarian aid no longer exist. That would require security, staff who can work in safety, logistical capacity, and the resumption of commercial activity. It requires electricity and steady communications. All of these remain absent, end quote. Indeed, only shortly after Israel opened the Kerem Shalom crossing to goods in late December 2023, it was struck in a drone attack, killing five Palestinians and leading to another temporary closure. Nowhere and nobody is safe. As the United Nations Secretary General and all its chiefs have made clear, without a halt to Israel's military operations, crossings, aid convoys and humanitarian workers, like everyone and everything else in Gaza, remain at imminent risk of further irreparable prejudice. An unprecedented 148 United Nations staff have been killed to date. Without a halt to Israel's military activity in Gaza, there will be no end to the extreme situation facing Palestinian civilians. Madam President, members of the court, if the indication of provisional measures was justified on the facts in those cases I have cited, how could it not be here, in a situation of much greater severity, where the imminent risk of irreparable harm is so much greater? How could they not be justified in a situation that humanitarian veterans from crises spanning as far back as the killing fields of Cambodia, people who, in the words of the United Nations Secretary General, have seen everything, if they say it is so utterly unprecedented that they are out of words to describe it? It would be a complete departure from the long and established line of jurisprudence that this court has firmly established and recently reconfirmed for the court not to order provisional measures in this case. The imminent risk of death, harm, and destruction that Palestinians in Gaza face today and that they risk every day during the pendency of these proceedings, on any view justifies, indeed compels, the indication of provisional measures. Some might say that the very reputation of international law, its ability and willingness to bind and to protect all peoples equally, hangs in the balance. But the Genocide Convention is about much more than legal precedent. It is also fundamentally about the confirmation and endorsement of elementary principles of morality. The Court recalled the 1946 General Assembly resolution on the crime of genocide, which made clear that, I quote, "Genocide is a denial of the right of existence of entire human groups, as homicide is the denial of the right to live of individual human beings. Such denial of the right of existence shocks the conscience of mankind, results in great losses to humanity in the form of cultural and other contributions represented by these human groups, and is contrary to moral law and to the spirit and aims of the United Nations." End quote. Notwithstanding the Genocide Convention's recognition of the need to rid the world of the odious scourge of genocide, the international community has repeatedly failed. It failed the people of Rwanda. It had failed the Bosnian people and the Rohingya, prompting this court to take action. It failed again by ignoring the early warnings of the grave risk of genocide to the Palestinian people, sounded by international experts since 19th of October of last year. The international community continues to fail the Palestinian people, despite the overt, dehumanizing, genocidal rhetoric by Israeli governmental and military officials, matched by the Israeli army's actions on the ground. Despite the horror of the genocide against the Palestinian people being live-streamed from Gaza to our mobile phones, computers, and television screens, the first genocide in history where its victims are broadcasting their own destruction in real time in the desperate, so far vain hope that the world might do something. Gaza represents nothing short of a moral failure, as described by the usually circumspect International Committee of the Red Cross. As underscored by United Nations chiefs, that failure has, I quote, "repercussions not just for the people of Gaza, but for the generations to come who will never forget these over 90 days of hell and assaults on the most basic precepts of humanity." As stated by a United Nations spokesperson in Gaza last week, at the site of a hospital clearly marked with the symbol of the Red Crescent, where five Palestinians, including a five-day-old baby, had just been killed, "The world should be absolutely horrified. The world should be absolutely outraged. There is no safe space in Gaza, and the world should be ashamed." South Africa is here before this court in the Peace Palace. It has done what it could. It is doing what it can by initiating these proceedings, by seeking interim measures against itself as well as against Israel. South Africa now respectfully and humbly calls on this honourable court to do what is in its power to do, to indicate the provisional measures that are so urgently required to prevent further irreparable harm to the Palestinian people in Gaza, whose hopes, including for their very survival, are now vested in this court.
That was Blin Ni Grale speaking before the International Court of Justice. Next, we present a summary and analysis of the opening arguments before the court with former federal judge Andrew Napolitano speaking with Columbia University professor Jeffrey Sachs.
Hi, everyone. Judge Andrew Napolitano here for Judging Freedom. Today is Thursday, January 11th, 2024. Professor Jeffrey Sachs joins us from Cambodia. That's Professor, you never astound me where you're going to pop up. Crystal clear and looking youthful as ever, but thank you very much for joining us here.
Great to be with you. Greetings from Phnom Penh.
Thank you. Professor Sachs, as we speak, it's 9 o'clock at night in Phnom Penh. It's 9 in the morning here in New Jersey. It's 3 or 4, forgive my ignorance, in the afternoon in Brussels. But as we speak, the International Court of Justice of the United Nations is meeting and hearing the complaint of South Africa versus Israel alleging genocide. So first, how serious, how compelling, how detailed is the complaint?
Well, this is an absolutely astounding day, a historic day. South Africa has filed an application with the International Court of Justice. This is the UN's global court in The Hague in the Netherlands, and it addresses disputes between governments. In this case, this is a dispute brought by South Africa claiming that Israel is undertaking genocidal actions and with genocidal intent. And the legal basis for this complaint, this application to the International Court of Justice, is that both South Africa and Israel are parties to the 1948 Genocide Convention. And so this is a complaint that South Africa is making, that it is entitled to make as a signatory to the Genocide Convention, which compels all of the signatory countries, including Israel, to abide by the terms of the Genocide Convention. It's stunning, amazing to watch these proceedings. South Africa filed an extremely detailed application, 84 pages, describing both the intentionality of Israel in destroying Gaza, in making Gaza uninhabitable, and the actions of Israel in bombing core infrastructure, in blocking the inflows of water, food, medicine, fuel, that are basic necessities of life. And the combination of the statements by Israeli leaders, from the prime minister and president through the cabinet to members of the Knesset to leaders of the Israel Defense Forces, is a shocking list of statements, because these are statements saying flat out that Gaza is to be destroyed, is to be made uninhabitable, that there is no distinction between Hamas and the civilians, that everybody is guilty. And no doubt these Israeli leaders would like to walk back what they said, because what they said was flat out unbelievably ugly and destructive. And I think South Africa makes a compelling case, expressive of genocidal intent. So to watch this in a body of law rather than in the spin of, say, a White House briefing or somebody just brushing this aside, as John Kirby did when he said, well, this is a bunch of nonsense. The United States, rejects all of this as nonsense, or the president of Israel saying this is a blood libel. But to hear it spelled out methodically, hour after hour in precise judicial proceedings, is I think, a historic day, because Israel is being examined closely for what it has said and what it is doing. And this is, to my mind, the highest responsibility and application of the concept of international law. So I think it's a very big day.
The law is very clear, and so our listeners know why you dwelt extensively on intent, and why the document itself quotes at length statements from Prime Minister Netanyahu and from many, many people in the Israeli government who pull the levers of power, and the things they said were utterly repellent. You seem to have paused for a second trying to find an adjective horrific enough to describe what they said, but things like burn them alive, bury them alive, they're subhuman. How do you characterize that? What kind of a mind can justify that kind of slaughter of innocents? But to my point, the law requires that the applicant here, South Africa, show not only that genocide took place, but that it wasn't an accident, that it was intentional. And when you can use, I can tell you this from my prior life on the bench, when you can use the words of your adversary to prove your case, that is the most compelling way to prove your case. Let's watch just a minute or so of the initial opening argument this morning. You may have seen this already, Professor Sachs. This is cut 13, Jeff, the opening statement.
The violence and the destruction in Palestine and Israel did not begin on the 7th of October 2023. The Palestinians have experienced systematic oppression and violence for the last 76 years. On 6 October 2023 and every day since October the 7th, 2023, in the Gaza Strip, at least since 2004, Israel continues to exercise control over the airspace, territorial waters, land crossing, water, electricity, and civilian infrastructure, as well as over key government functions. No armed attack on a state territory, no matter how serious, even an attack involving atrocity crimes, can provide any justification for or defense to breaches to the convention, whether as a matter of law or morality. Israel's response to the 7th of October 2023 attack has crossed this line. And
last clip, just for those unfamiliar with this kind of a court proceeding, the very end of the clip, you saw all 15 judges, two judges added to the panel, one from Israel, one from South Africa. The other 13 are permanent. It's interesting. I thought of you, Professor Sachs, when I saw the name of the person was added. And I saw the last name, Barak, and I thought, oh, my God, this is the former prime minister and former general. But it's not. It's the former chief justice of the Israeli Supreme Court, an opponent of Prime Minister Netanyahu, whom the Israeli government designated. He's 87 years old, but he's the grand old man, if you will, of Israel law and judiciary, universally respected, and they designated him. I want you to see one more argument before you weigh in. And this is the argument of another lawyer for South Africa who shows a video. And I want you to be able to assess the significance of the video that he shows. Chris?
On 7 December 2023, Israeli soldiers proved that they understood the Prime Minister's message to remember what the Amalek has done to you as genocider. They were recorded by journalists dancing and singing. We know our motto, there are no uninvolved, that they obey one commandment to wipe off the seed of Amalek. The Prime Minister's invocation of Amalek is being used by soldiers to justify the killing of civilians, including children. These are the soldiers repeating the inciting words of their Prime Minister.
All right, well, let's start at the end. What is the significance of Israeli soldiers in Gaza dancing and chanting, "We come to address Amalek"?
Well, there is a very important subtext to all of this, which is the use of biblical symbology and biblical and religious beliefs that are part of Israel's rhetoric and core to Israel's politics. Amalek is a part of the Bible when the Israelites are instructed by God to kill all of this nation. And it is one of many genocides, in fact, in the Old Testament. The book of Joshua, which is the part of the Bible, the sixth book of the Old Testament, in which the Israelites, after having escaped from Egypt, in the Exodus from Egypt, arrive at their promised land and are instructed by God, according to the book of Joshua, to not only take the land, but to kill every man, woman, and child in the land that they are to take. And it's very clear repeatedly from one nation to the next in the book of Joshua that this is to be a genocide, that no one shall survive. Now, fast forward 2,600 years, and this text, these texts are being referred to explicitly by the prime minister, by the Israel Defense Forces, and by a large part of the Israeli politics, much of which reflects a religious zealotry that takes the Bible as the literal basis for action. And the Bible has in these texts the instructions for genocide, for killing everybody. Mm. And we hear this echo not only in the video that the South African lawyer showed, but in a shocking compilation of videos that Gray Zone produced. Max Blumenthal, the investigative reporter, produced, released, and posted on Gray Zone a compilation that is filled one after another with this biblical reference, this genocidal fever, and the chanting and delight at the destruction of everybody. So what we're seeing here is a mix of military brutality, religious zealotry, political manipulation in a concoction that is extraordinary. I think it is so foreign to our eyes to see this, but in the court, to have it laid out so explicitly, and the court is a place of decorum. You saw the lawyer, how dignified and eloquent he was. I listened to much of his presentation earlier in the day, and the room was silent, listening, having to absorb this direct evidence, not having the ever-present and, for me, utterly disgusting spin from the White House newsroom or some other spin, but actually listening to the realities, grim realities, laid out one by one. That's why I think this was a historic day.
Here's what the White House actually had to say about it. This is, I think you've seen this, and I know you won't be happy, and neither am I, but we have to expose this stuff. Here's Admiral Kirby expressing the White House's opinion on the, this is 3 or 4 days ago, so this is before the oral argument, on the application, the 84-page complaint filed by South Africa.
South Africa's filed this 84-page lawsuit against Israel, accusing them of genocide. Israel says that this is blood libel. Does Washington agree? And where does this put Washington and Pretoria in
terms of the relations? We find this submission meritless, counterproductive, and completely without any basis in fact whatsoever.
I guess he didn't read it if he finds it meritless, counterproductive, and completely without any basis in fact. And I guess Washington is the only country in the world willing to make a statement as outrageous as that.
You know, I find him insufferable day by day.
I do know that.
Yes. You know, I don't exactly hide it, because I just wish there were grown-ups in power, grown-ups who were responsible, who were honest, who were decent, who would read an 84-page detailed complaint and give a serious answer rather than a one-sentence smack-off like that. I wish at the same time that the White House press corps would follow up more seriously. Actually, if I remember correctly, that question started with a few words, just a quick one. Right. And then the question was asked, and Kirby responded in this utterly disgusting way when the most important issue on the planet is in front of him, and couldn't do more than one dismissive, phony, and false statement. But then there's no follow-up. Then they move on to the next topic and the next topic.
I sometimes think those questions are staged, Jeff, and it's terrible. It's terrible for the American public, and it's demeaning to the profession of journalism.
Yes. How could the journalist say, Mr. Kirby, it's 84 detailed pages, and you say there's no factual basis? Why don't we look at page 10? Why don't we look at page 12? Why don't the journalists do their job?
Right.
Rather than feeding us the propaganda from the White House, they should be questioning the propaganda. That's why I was grateful for today's court proceedings, because there were hours to put forward the evidence. There is a detailed legal complaint. There are dozens of countries that have supported this, but the U.S. government is all spin, all propaganda, and all attempt at narrative control. And Judge Napolitano, that's why you're doing such a service, because you're bringing these issues to the public attention and to the world attention. But the press that's in that room doesn't even follow up with a another question.
Right. Your criticism of the press is right on. Should we expect tomorrow? Today is all opening arguments from the lawyers from South Africa. Tomorrow, the Israeli lawyers, who, by the way, are British barristers, take over. What conceivable defense could there be? What mentality of humanity justifies the slaughter of 26,000 people, at most 3,000 of whom were soldiers?
Well, they're going to say that this is in self-defense, that a terrible terrorist attack occurred on October 7, which is true. But as the South African prosecutor said today, that is no defense under the Genocide Convention. They're going to say that these statements are aimed at Hamas, their military enemy, not at the civilian population. That is plainly false, because the statements are explicit about all of the population. They're going to say that they take exquisite care in protecting the civilians, which is utterly false, because they have put a siege on Gaza, stopped the food, the water, the fuel, the medical supplies. They are going to say that they are careful in their targeting of Hamas, which is plainly false, because 70% of those killed are women and children, and many of the men killed are absolutely not Hamas soldiers. So Israel is going to have a defense of self-defense, but they're going to deny what is plainly in front of the world's eyes, which are genocidal statements that are pervasive and rampant, and actions against the entire civilian population, not at all targeted at a massive loss of life that is overwhelmingly civilian, and the displacement of 2 million people, where Hamas has perhaps 30,000 fighters. So Israel is going to make a defense of self-defense that is itself not defensible, because the plain facts are contrary to what Israel has been saying every day since this invasion into Gaza began.
Do you have a finger on the pulse of how American Jews view the genocide? I mean, I understand Joe Biden is caught in a vice. He's caught between the donor class, the AIPAC folks, and younger people that are traditionally Democrats, but who are horrified by the genocide. So question one is, should the United States be a co-defendant? And then if we come back to the U.S., you know, you live and work at Columbia University, a large Jewish American population in Manhattan. You have a finger on the pulse about how they feel. Answer either question in which either order you wish, any order you wish.
Well, I think it's quite clear from the opinion surveys that the broad American public is aghast at what's happening, because they're watching, like all of us, day by day, a slaughter of civilians. I think it's clear that there is a generational gradient, as you pointed out, where young people are absolutely defending the Gazan civilian population, whereas older people are tending more towards backing Israel, because that is the way that it has been for decades. But even so, even among older respondents to the opinion surveys, there is a tremendous, tremendous unease. And in the Jewish community, of course, it's very divided. It's divided by age. It's divided by class. It's divided by interest group. It's divided by different parts of American Jewry, from Reform to Orthodox. But even within Orthodox Jewry, the most religious, there are parts of Orthodox Jewry, notably the Satmar community in Brooklyn, New York, which says that the whole concept of Israel and Zionism was misconceived, because in their view, it was religiously misconceived. Of course, other Orthodox Jews take a different view. So it's a lot of division. What we don't have is any overwhelming groundswell of support for Israel in this. Quite the contrary. The American people, every time they're asked and have an opportunity to speak, say, ceasefire now.
Right.
Americans do not want to be complicit in this massacre and in this genocide, as South Africa is describing it today in the International Court of Justice.
And, should the U.S. be a co-defendant, Professor Sachs?
Well, the U.S. is going to be a co-defendant in the court of public opinion, because the overwhelming understanding of the world is that Israel could not do this from one day to the next without the United States' active support. And it is active support in one absolutely key way, which is providing the bombs, the munitions, the artillery, the shells that are killing people and that are destroying the habitability and the infrastructure, and that have displaced nearly the entire population. And so the Americans wring their hands. Blinken says, we have to take more care of civilians and so forth, but then signs an order that subverts congressional oversight to directly deliver the munitions to Israel. No strings attached, no conditions whatsoever, so that this continues. So America is complicit. And a subtext of this is that America is on trial as well, because America is Israel's sole backer in the military campaign that is underway in Gaza.
You have been listening to Judge Andrew Napolitano in conversation with Columbia Professor Jeffrey Sachs. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, and on KKRN.org, where you can stream us live every Monday morning, 9 a.m. Eastern Time. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you will be with us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.